I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Trevor Carolyn joins me now. The noted writer has just written a new book, The Literary Storefront, The Glory Years, Vancouver's Literary Center, 1978 to 1985. It's a history of the legendary and lamented institution that existed to foster the literary arts and help redefine the writing culture in the city, founded by Mona Fertig, who was inspired by Shakespeare and company in Paris. The book chronicles the many distinguished writers, local and international, who read and visited the literary storefront. I'll get Mr. Carolyn to tell us about these years in Vancouver. He does a great service recording something important in the history of this city. Trevor Carolyn is a writer who began his career at the age of 17 as a reporter at San Francisco's The Columbia newspaper. He is the international editor of Pacific Rim Review of Books, and teaches at the University of the Fraser Valley in Abbotsford. His first public reading in Canada was at the Literary Storefront, and I'll get him to tell us of his experiences. The website for more is at trevorcarolyn.com. This book is from Mother Tongue Publishing. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Trevor Carolyn. Mr. Carolyn, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Things are looking good out here in Deep Cove.
Yeah, I understand the book launched here in Vancouver a couple weeks ago.
About 10 days ago, and it was a wonderful evening at the Western Front with a big crowd and many of the old faces from the glory days at the storefront, and it was very heartening to see a good number of eminent faces from the culture world and, you know, the world of scholarly activity turning up. It was great.
Yeah, and as I said before we started, it's a wonderful book because it tells us about this history that would have been forgotten otherwise.
Well, I think you've picked up on the right thing there, Joseph. I was invited to write this book. That was part of it. And I was really only able to do that. It took 4 years of work to bring this book together. I was really only able to do that because of for the last number of years, I've been enjoying an academic teaching position, something that I came to fairly late in my career. And the University of the Fraser Valley offered some generous scholarly support to enable me to do that. What I mean is that I was able to hire a couple of our senior English students who looked like they had a career in mind with books and publishing, and was able to hire them for a couple of stretches during 2 summers. And they were able to do an awful lot of work with me. I was able to direct them to libraries to search for certain things. That's what really made it happen.
And so there is a rich archive that you were able to mine in the course of writing this book?
Well, it took some digging, but we knew that. At the very beginning, we started off with sending out a questionnaire, sending a letter and a questionnaire to as many of the writers that a group of us can remember from the literary storefront days, because it's been fading already. It was the late 70s up to the mid-80s. It sounds alarming, but that's over 30 years ago already.
Mm-hmm.
So we began with that, and while we were waiting for responses, the initial response was not that heartening. It was pretty light from writers. You would think people would be interested to participate, but they're busy. Then we began thinking, where can we find the material? And we found that the Vancouver Public Library had a good series of archives, and we found then that we knew that the UBC Special Collections at the Barber Library had acquired the papers of the Literary Storefront from Mona. So we knew there were a couple of places that we could start mining. They call it data mining, which I think is a really good word, because that's what you're doing. You're excavating through these layers of history.
Yeah, and so because the place closed 30 years ago, and but people still remembered it fondly, didn't they?
Oh, I think they did, because it was such a seminal institution. I think one of the things maybe that the introduction to the book points out, I worked to try and present information for younger people in the community, or newer writers, or people who didn't live here at that time. People who've come up in Vancouver would have been familiar with it. We knew that. But there's a whole other generation that have come to the writing game now. And we wanted to, really let them know where some of the ideas or some of the ways that we do things, where those came from, and how certain things originated here. The storefront was pretty unique in that it was literally a storefront location. So there was a place where you could go by at 1 o'clock in the afternoon or 11 o'clock in the morning if you just happened to be in town, and you could be pretty sure that it was going to be open. You could drop by. So there was always a place to be. And then that place made itself available, obviously, for readings when people were, had new books or wanted to do a program of work or get something out there in public. But it had a reading library. It was a place to go and make connections. And I think really valuably in terms of, let's just talk about the vocational aspect of writing, which is always a kind of a gray area. How do you get information about this line of work, this activity, this art? The storefront was available to just about anybody for an absolutely minimal rental fee so that you could put on an event. And that was how an awful lot of us either A, acquired information about different aspects of the writing and publishing world, Joseph, or B, we could put something on to bring people in that would give us information that we felt we needed. And so it became a... it became an alternative learning center about the world of writing, of books, of publishing, all of that, as well as different affiliated culture things. There are music events would happen,
right.
Different types of performance art, art exhibits, photo exhibits. It was really not just the literary world, but it had a whole affiliated kind of satellite network of other interests that came together to make that scene. And that's what it became. It became actually a cultural scene in Vancouver that was really central to the city's writing and publishing world for an important period of time.
So I was born in 1982, so I obviously missed all of this.
Holy cow!
So, but you know, when reading the book, it's not difficult to get nostalgic about what was happening in this city and in that era. So would you tell us, you know, those of us listening, just about what the culture scene was like in Vancouver in those years, the late 70s through to the early 80s?
Well, Vancouver was very much a different city, and that's one of the things that the first reviews that have been coming out about the book have been noting, how significant the difference was between then and now. And I was swapping some notes with Eric Spaulding, who teaches at UFV, who originally from Montreal, really knowledgeable fellow. We were talking, he said he had been around for part of the time, but what was it that made the significant difference between, let's say, then and now? And I thought about that, and it became very clear that the timing, the demise of the literary storefront came in 1985. And at that moment, when we began talking about this, what was going on in the city toward the end of it, we can get to the beginning in a moment if you like, but toward the end of it, suddenly it became clear that the grant funding, the administrative direction of certain projects, a lot of the Vancouver civic planning, provincial planning, a lot of the encouragement that might normally have been going, let's say, to the arts in its different manifestations, suddenly was going to that enormous project called Expo 86.
Mm.
And I think the only thing similar that we could offer up by comparison for, let's say, newer people or younger people would be the Winter Olympics recently, where the whole city was seemed to be geared up into that program. There was so much going on, energy, finance, all kinds of things were being directed to that project. That pretty much helped to spell the end of the literary storefront. And, of course, at the same time, it made it possible for some other, it made space for other organizations to begin rooting and growing. I think the Kootenai School of Writing, for example.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That was going on. But in the beginning, in the late 70s, there was a sense of fatigue in the city. At that time, let's remember, it was disco mania was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday Night Fever, disco mania. It was culture light. People were escaping. It had been the end of the Vietnam War down in the United States. The economic picture was not great. There was separatist difficulties in Quebec. The general mood was, there was a kind of malaise, or there was an uncertainty hovering in the air, and of course that would naturally percolate down into the arts community. And in Vancouver, if you were a young writer, there just didn't seem to be many places to get a foothold. That's the one thing that people said over and over and over when I was doing the research, interviewing, going out seeing people. The storefront suddenly offered a place where people could actually get up and read their work at these at this interesting phenomena that developed there of open mic readings. There were so few of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at Vancouver, we've got, there are slam events, there's different reading events, there's performance work. It goes on and on and on. And And almost every night of the week, there's something going on in Vancouver in terms of literary structure. It'll be a workshop, a reading, something going on. At that time, there were much fewer. And one of the things that a number of women writers pointed out in particular, the events that were going on in the city tended more often than not to be taking place at educational institutions. Mm-hmm. Capilano College, Langara, UBC, maybe SFU. There were few places to really do things in a public way, in a public spirit. And suddenly the storefront came along and made that possible.
And in Gastown at the time was still pretty, I mean, it wasn't, it isn't what it is today, I guess. I mean, it was still pretty old warehouses and the sort, right?
It was. And I remember that very vividly because my dad was a builder, a bricklayer and a stonemason with a small company. And he got involved at a fairly early period in the 70s, in 72, 73, with some of the historic renovation that was going on down there. It was a pretty rundown area. The neighborhood was dodgy. And there was some money coming through. It was the Trudeau era, and the Pierre Trudeau era in Canadian government. And money was forthcoming. It was a pretty good time in the economy in the early 70s. There was money forthcoming for renovation projects, heritage things, trying to develop tourist areas, networking sites that would attract visitors and so forth down near the waterfront. And Gastown was decided to become such a place. Granville Island was another. These were really federally driven initiatives. So Gastown was funky, a bit run down, and it was still the heart of a large rag trade industry. There was an enormous amount of cloth making, of clothing manufacturing taking place in Gastown in those old 3, 4, 5-story buildings, those brick buildings. That's what was going on down there. So there was a population going there, but that industry itself was in transition.
Mm.
And what that meant was there were spaces that could be used as lofts by artists, by musicians, by early punks. And that was something that was starting to take place in Gastown as well. So you had that transition moment, kind of like what was taking place in New York when you had that early Soho, the kind of the boho scene where loft culture, loft mm-hmm. events going on. And it would not be uncommon for a young writer, if you were trying to hustle stories, to go down there and meet some of the early punk musicians, Jim Cummings, bands like that. Brain Eater would be down there. A lot of painters. I remember looking for Jim Cummings one time for an interview and knocking on a door because I heard music coming from it. Somebody opened the door, and it was Bob Vandermay, the painter, and he said, "Well, if you can't find a musician, why don't you story about art?" And we were on the third floor of an old brick warehouse building, sewing machines going away down the hall, and people here living in these kind of funky alternative situations. So that was what was going on in Gastown, as well as a pretty thriving music scene, in the bars that were pretty rugged down there. It's where you would bump into people like Peter Trower, the great poet, of course.
Yeah. And so this is the genesis of the literary storefront. I mean, that goes to Mona Fertig, right?
Oh, absolutely. It was Mona's idea from the get-go. Mona tells a good story. She was, she was a young kid that grew up around the area from a working-class family, and I think we could probably say a lower working-class family. They didn't have much. They moved out of Vancouver. She moved down toward Marine Drive near New Westminster, where I grew up, down near the river. And there had been a little bit of an art scene, even out in the suburbs. Painters like Leo LaBelle, Mona's dad, George Fertig. There was a small art culture trying to make it out there. Joe Cambis was another painter. My dad had run a club during the folk scene in the very early 60s. My dad ran a club with a partner, Jerry Wolfson, who had a little music shop in New Westminster, these two Irish guys, Irish Catholic and Irish Jew, like a TV show. And they ran this club together. And Jerry, because of his music store, could play just about anything. He could play piano, play drums, and play trumpet. So he was a bit of a one-man band. But they were bringing people through, Sonny Terry and Bronya McGee, Spencer Mohart, some of the touring acts of that time. That's who I grew up with. And that was the area that Mona was growing up in, too. And a neighbor of hers, Beth Jankola, who became the poet Beth Jankola, one day brought a book over to her and said, "Mona, you've got to read this." And it was Sylvia Beach's great book about her many, many decades' experience with the Shakespeare and Company in Paris, which is still thriving across the just across the river from Notre Dame Cathedral. That was the genesis. So with that in mind, Moti decided she needed to get this project underway. And that was a natural outgrowth of the local high school, post-high school art projects she had been doing already in the spirit of the times in the late 60s.
Yeah, so you chronicled the years that she spent there. It was about 4 years, right?
What, in at the storefront?
Yeah.
She well, there was the startup time, and then you had, you know, a, we might say 1977 up until 1982 when she finally was burnt out and left to go out to Montreal for a time.
Yeah, it was a full-time job, and you chronicle through the book just how much it all cost, how she raised the money. I mean, there's a lot of applications for grants and the sort. I mean, some of the figures though amaze me, at, you know, in retrospect.
What, the? You mean the staggering guerrilla budget cheapness of it?
Yeah, that too, yeah. I mean,
it was. It was done on a shoestring.
Yeah.
There was no... That's one of the things that I think younger people particularly now need to understand. There was no official money in those times.
Yeah.
This was done on a hope and a prayer. Mona heard about the Canada Council Explorations Grants. That was her first look at something serious, and she was able to apply for a fairly small grant, which she succeeded in getting, and she got a letter to this effect from Burke Taylor, who himself became a longtime Western Canadian National Arts Administrator. I believe Burke is still working out at UBC these days. If you're out there, Burke, howdy, it's Trevor. Burke Taylor sent her a letter saying she'd succeeded in getting this small amount of funding, an exploration grant, to fund something like the Literary Storefront Arts Center, because the Canada Council, of course, couldn't fund a private business like a bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
So from the beginning, there was a sense that this was going to be an art center focused on literature and books. And that, with that little bit of startup money that did come from a government source, Mona was able to begin then hustling to come up with projects that could help pay the rent and help get a little bit of money for, you know, passing the hat at readings, having book sales, selling books and magazines during the day, selling memberships.
Yeah.
They sold bricks. The place had brick walls that had been cleaned up, and you could put your name on a brick. So for a small contribution, you could have that. That was your brick. And when you came in there, you saw your place, like people who go to the opera, the symphony, the... You can see people's names on seats who've made donations. So it was a continual struggle for them, looking to find money. And that situation hasn't much changed. There is more government funding these days, but only because when places like the storefront had to leave the scene, suddenly their absence became it was gaping. Then governments began realizing, my goodness, we really do need these things.
Yeah,
it was a pretty good bargain in terms of the bang that they got for their buck. I think showing people how to make work, find work, create work, how to earn a living, how to do things. It was a tremendous learning center, as well as a literary place to do readings and hobnob and meet people and so forth, which was a huge part of the storefront. That was one of the neatest parts of it all.
So how did the literary storefront change the literary scene in Vancouver? Because Patrick Lane, who you quote in the book, is described in one of his letters, describes Vancouver as being known for its cliques, its cliques, a lot of backbiting in the literary community. Even when it started, there was a little bit of, there was still some of that, wasn't there?
There was plenty of that. That's all there was. In fairness, you had UBC School of Creative Writing. It's out in, you know, Point Grey there. It's its own little world. You had the Tisch group of writers and poets who had come out of UBC under the tutorship of Warren Tallman, who had a lot of influence for a very long period of time in Vancouver. There was the Western Front avant-garde art community over there near Maine, roughly sort of Maine and Broadway area.
Mm-hmm.
There was a group that might informally be called the Downtown Poets, who are, I think, the most democratic. The Jerry Gilbert or the Maxine Gadd, Judith Copperthorne, many of that group of poets who are not affiliated with academic world or something like that. So there were these groups, or as Patrick would call them, these cliques. Yes, and that's what made it very difficult for a young person who was wanting to get involved to find a place to get involved, to do something with a book or trying to read. Unless you were somehow affiliated with one of these groups, it was hard to find a place. There just weren't spaces to do much. A very odd reading at the Vancouver Public Library, perhaps, but mm-hmm. you pretty well need to be involved with some kind of group to get invited there. A very odd reading at a bookstore once in a while, but that was rather infrequent. For a young writer, I remember coming up, I'm not from San Francisco. I had gone down there as a young writer to do some writing kind of in that hippie psychedelic times. I'd come back to BC, and then for a couple of years I got enrolled in university down there. And I came back in 1978, and the storefront was up and running by that point. And I'd begun writing poetry stories in Northern California at Humboldt State, where I was there, where Ray Carver, the great Ray Carver, had just left as a teacher when I was there, still living in the area. Jim Dodge was one of my teachers, one of the kind of alternative poets in the States. I came back, and I had a book full of poems in my pocket that I was carrying around everywhere the way young poets do, you know, my little black book. And where could I do something? What could I do with it? I ended up living back in New Westminster. Where do you get involved? For me, I had a lucky break that happened, and that's what opened the door. It introduced me to the literary storefront. And that's in the book, too. But there were very few places at that time. And I think for younger writers especially, it can almost feel like that even these days. But there are some options. There are places you can get plugged in. You know, there's the Cottage Bistro readings, the mm-hmm. Twisted Poets series on Main Street. There are different festivals at Trout Lake. There's the Harmony Arts Festival in the summer in West Van. There's an awful lot of places that you can get things going, or read up and down the drive, or places in East Van at art galleries. But a lot of those ideas came from the literary storefront model. That's mm-hmm. I think that's where we started out with this question. It was the storefront that helped create a template for a lot of the events that followed.
And so you mentioned that Mona had spent 4 years, got burnt out. She went to Montreal, her and Peter. And then these two guys, Thomas, how do you pronounce his name, Ilves?
Thomas Ilves, yeah.
Yeah, and Wayne Holder, they come in.
That's correct.
And so you were around town at the time, right? And so what happened with the storefront at that point?
Well, Mona's particular genius had been to try and share the work around. She knew she couldn't keep it all up herself as much as she did, but she brought in a lot of friends and acquaintances, brought in a lot of writers, made it possible for people to get involved. When I was doing research for the book, I was surprised to see my name turning up. I'd signed my name at different events, or on, you know, my name would turn up on different pieces of paper that I was looking up all these years later. And I had no memory of the events where they'd happened, because I went to, you know, numbers of events there over the years. Mona was able to get people organized with a volunteer group who organized himself into committees, a readings committee, a publications committee, doing the monthly newsletter and so on, fundraising committee. And when Mona was absolutely worn out from not having a salary, working, having to try and earn a living, trying to keep this literary center going, she finally did leave out from exhaustion. She'd been continually trying to get some funding support from the BC government, and they kept stalling. There was nothing coming. There was a lot of talk, a lot of promises, good letters. Nothing happened. So she finally, at the point of exhaustion, left. And among the volunteers who had risen up in these committees were these two fellows, Tom Ilves and Wayne Holder. And basically through default, nobody else had the energy or the time to step up. These two fellows did step up and got involved then in the day-to-day running of the place. That's how that happened.
And spoiler alert, Mr. Ilves, I guess, is the president of Estonia today. Is that right?
That's one of the interesting stories in the book. Yeah, Thomas Ilves is now the president of the small country of Estonia, and he has to, on a regular basis, spar with Vladimir Putin. That's stress. But when you think about it, some of his early training, you know, came through the literary storefront, the way it came for a lot of us in different projects that happened there.
Were you able to talk to him in the course of writing this book?
I sent a number of letters to him. We had a Skype interview lined up, and we were all set to go to Skype. And at that moment, the crisis in the Ukraine blew up, and I got Crimea blew up, and I got an urgent message saying sorry, but he was having to travel to Washington, and we try and reschedule, and it didn't come around. But as these things go, I did keep him informed. I wrote letters, and the evening of the launch, just over a week ago, 2 weekends ago, about 10 minutes before the event, somebody came up. We had a wonderful telegram that came through from President Elvis, wishing everybody well, saying he was sorry he couldn't be there, but he was there in spirit, and he sent along a bottle of champagne with that. So that was pretty nice of him.
Yeah, and it shows up on his Wikipedia or his bio, I guess, doesn't it? His time here.
Yeah, he notes it. I think that's probably put together by one of his staffers. The wording of his bio is a little inaccurate, but Vancouver Art Center. But yeah, he notes what he did here. After his time at the storefront, Tom, I believe, got invited to lecture on Estonian literature up at Simon Fraser for a year or two before he took a position then with Radio Free Europe, yeah, where he was based out of Munich for a time. And I remember getting a letter from him, a letter or two from him back at that time when he'd gone over there. He was with the Estonian section. It was still the Cold War period at that point, so yeah. They were broadcasting in behind what was called the Iron Curtain. That was what had drawn Tom and I together. I had traveled as a young man in Europe, and after seeing, you know, what was available over there, I got fascinated by going behind the barbed wire and having a look at Eastern Europe. So I had in 1971, 72, 73, I traveled into much of the Iron Curtain countries there, and that was a scary world. It was a difficult world, and I didn't have the rosy picture of organized socialist states that some of my colleagues over here would have. I'd been there, I'd sort of seen the jackboots, and I'd been pushed around and picked up by the police, and it wasn't easy to be there. You stood out like a nail in just a sheet of plywood.
Mm-hmm.
So I somehow mentioned that at some point to Tom, and he'd been interested in that because he was looking to see that world himself.
What happened to Sylvia? Sylvia?
No, which Sylvia is that?
That mannequin?
Oh, I think Mona probably took that. When she returned from Montreal, she came back to the storefront, and she wasn't particularly happy with the direction that the new place was following, how things were being done. Tom and Wayne had a different management style. It was not as grassroots focused, and they were not local boys, so they didn't have the same connection that Mona had. So she took out some of the things that she'd left behind, and I think that was where the Sylvia Beach doll went.
Yeah, and the podium, I guess that's still around, isn't it?
The podium showed up, I think, at the launch at the Western Front. It was amazing to see it again.
Yeah.
So some of the artifacts from the old Missouri storefront came to the Western Front that evening. The podium, they set up some of the old photographs that used to be on the wall of Ezra Pound, Sylvia Beach, maybe T.S. Eliot, I'm trying to think. They were arrayed. So there was something of the effect of the Literary Storefront stage when Bill Bissett came up to do just a fabulous performance. Gene Barman did a short reading and a talk. I was reading. Daniela Elzer read one of Nellie McClung's poems about the night that Lawrence Ferlinghetti came down to the storefront. So it was quite an event. You had something of that feel. Peter, Mona's husband, was the MC, and he was strumming his guitar away. So you had some of that same old vibe of the storefront. It was very nostalgic for a lot of people. It was a great night, actually.
Yeah, and this book is, as I said, it's a wonderful service. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it. It's been a pleasure having you on and talking about it today.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure.
The book is called The Literary Storefront, The Glory Years of Vancouver's Literary Center, The Glory Years, Vancouver's Literary Center, 1978 to 1985. It's from Mother Tongue Publishing. TrevorCarolyn.com is the website, and the book's author, Trevor Carolyn, joined me on the line from his home in Deep Cove in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.